religious Zionism won. Because as you know, Israel is a country for lots of different types of Jews. It doesn't really follow halakha. It doesn't follow the Torah. On the other hand, it is a Jewish country. And my question really is, what is the attitude when it comes to Israel? And I'm sure you've seen, to me, terribly embarrassing. Sometimes you see Hasidim at these rallies on the other side. Maybe it's a small group, but they make a lot of noise. And they're holding up pro-Palestinian flags, and they seem to be anti-Zionist. What is that? Is that representative of a larger group? I want you guys to be knowledgeable and learned in this area so you could understand what are the different attitudes out there when it comes to Israel. I personally consider myself an ardent Zionist, but I consider myself a religious Zionist, and it's a little different. Even though I just gave a lecture about Theodore Herzl, and I'm a big fan of his, but my attitude towards Israel is not really a Herzl one. It's more of Rav Kook, a Rav Soloveitchik one. But Herzl's kind of part of the whole piece. And I want to kind of discuss that with you, if that's okay. Take a look at the handout, the packet that I gave you. And you can take this handout home. It was written by a contemporary rabbi. His name is Alan Haber. And he starts off by saying the following. And by the way, there are some practical ramifications of this. And that is, next week is Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Memorial. I hope you guys will be able to join on Monday night. I'm interviewing an extraordinary woman, a Holocaust survivor. We used to actually have Holocaust survivors just come up and speak, but it's too difficult. They're much older. So it's easier just to have them seated, and we'll mic it so you could hear her. And we'll have like a conversation, and she'll be able to tell her story. Well into her 80s.
Oh.
Yeah.
The last Holocaust survivor you had took the stairs last year.
So the last Holocaust survivor we had was 90, supposed to be 95.
Right.
And he got sick the last minute, so his younger brother, who's only 92, came. And he got aggravated waiting for the elevator, so he walked down the temple.
But I knew it's like
that the guy was so spry. Remember?
So scary.
Yeah. Now the other brother was an academic. He was like a doctor, and he was a professor. This one was like a little more scrappy, which was good also because he was just like very down to earth kind of guy. I have no idea who this woman is.
I do know someone that I can ask if he wants to come and speak. He's also Holocaust survivor.
No, we have somebody. Please, I wanted to have a woman also. I thought it would be interesting. We had a man last year. Why? Oh, so that's Monday. The following Monday night, we're having Yom Ha'atzmaut event, which I think is really important to come to. Ironically, and maybe you can explain why this is, we always used to get more people to Yom HaShoah than Yom Ha'atzmaut. It always bothered me. Now, I'm happy a lot of people come to Yom HaShoah, obviously. But it always bothered me that, like, Israel is the future. The Holocaust is the past. We should be celebrating. We should be coming out in bigger numbers for Yom Ha'atzmaut, especially this year, post-October 7th. So I hope you guys will come. So take a look at the third paragraph on your handout, the Hashkafic issue. Hashkafic means the philosophical issue. Page 1, this is the first page. On the 5th of Iyar 5708, 1948, the State of Israel was declared. By the way, how was the State of Israel declared? Everyone needs to know this just on a political level.
UN.
The United Nations voted in favor of what's called
partition
to take the British mandated Palestine and to partition it, give a piece to the Jews, peace to the Arabs. How did the Jews react?
Accept it. Happy.
Yeah, go home tonight, put on YouTube. You can see some of the horror dancing that happened in Israel when they... How did the Arabs react?
War.
They attacked. So, first of all, the whole idea of a two-state solution was proposed by the United Nations in 1947, and it was rejected. Now, I'm not saying there weren't some Arab groups interested, perhaps, in a Palestinian state since, in a sincere fashion. But the idea that Israel's not interested in this, Israel was celebrating. And by the way, anybody know what territory Israel was given?
Very small.
Tiny. Israel tripled its size in the Six-Day War. Tripled. The Sinai Peninsula, the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, tripled Israel's size, the Golan Heights. Okay. So this was followed by the War of Independence, which had actually begun several months earlier, during which the greatly outnumbered, poorly trained, and poorly equipped Israeli army defeated the six Arab armies who attacked the fledgling state. This victory resulted in the first sovereign Jewish government in Eretz Israel, anywhere else in the world, for that matter, in several millennia. Does anybody know the last time Israel, the Jews, had sovereignty? 70 CE, when the Romans destroyed the Second Temple. Then on the 28th of Iyar 5727, 1967, during the miraculous Six-Day War, the Israeli army recaptured the holy city of Jerusalem, and the Jewish people heard those immortal words over the radio, Har Habayit Biyadenu, which means the Temple Mount is in our hands. In this war as well, the spectacular military victory seemed to have been against all odds. What is the appropriate spiritual reaction to these events? Many Jews see the hand of God very clearly in these events and therefore feel it appropriate to commemorate these events every year by saying Hallel. You guys know what Hallel is? How many of you guys said Hallel on Pesach? You're supposed to say Hallel when? Yeah. Pesach, Sukkot, and Shavuot. The three festivals we say Hallel. It's basically a bunch of psalms written by King David, put together by the rabbis. You're supposed to say Hallel when something amazing happens for the Jewish people. But you don't just say it willy-nilly. It has to be instituted by the rabbis. It's like a big deal. Starts with a blessing. You know you had a Hallel in the Haggadah. On your Seder night, there was a Hallel. So the question is the following. Yet others disagree. There are many synagogues that don't say Hallel on Yom HaTzma'ut. Why not? On this level, the debate is not really about Yom HaTzma'ut, which is Israeli Independence Day, or Yom Yerushalayim, which is the day commemorates the reunification of Jerusalem in the Six-Day War. Rather, it's about the state of Israel itself. What is our attitude towards the existence of the state of Israel? Now, he's not asking for political attitude. I think I can assume everyone in this room values the state of Israel as a safe haven, as a place to flee if, God forbid, there's another pogrom somewhere. As a place of our own self-determination, that we can charter our own destiny. I'm asking on a purely spiritual, religious level, what does the state of Israel mean to you, to us? Because if it doesn't mean anything religiously, then Yom HaTzmut shouldn't be any, I sent actually my kids to a school, and don't ask me why I sent them to the school, that's for a longer conversation, where they didn't say hello on Yom HaTzmut. I took them out of the school on that day, and I brought them to a different school that did. Because that's our philosophy. But the school that my three boys went to did not really celebrate. They weren't anti-Israel, the Medina, as they say, the state. But they really didn't see much religious value in Israel. When I say Israel, I'm not talking about the land. See, the land of Israel is not very controversial. What's the status of the land of Israel? The land. The dirt, the soil, living there. It's holy ground. It's a mitzvah to live there. It's one of the 613 mitzvot to live there. Does anyone disagree with that? No. There are 100,000 Satmar Jews who are not Zionists, but they live in Israel. Why? Because it's a mitzvah to live in Israel. It's nothing to do with politics or with Theodor Herzl or the government. It's a mitzvah to go to Israel. So I'm asking on a religious point of perspective. And by the way, you'll see this, not divide, well, it is a bit of a divide in Israel. You'll see this in the army, whether the people should be serving in the army or not. And you'll see a lot of religious Jews in the army, you'll see a lot of religious Jews not serving in the army. Like, what's the deal with that? We're going to come to it. But it all comes down to this discussion that we're going to have tonight and next week. Okay? Clearly, on this, the debate is not really about Yom HaTzmut, Yom HaTzmut, it's really about the state itself. What's our attitude? Clearly, this question will determine one's attitude towards Yom HaTzmut and Yom Yerushalayim, because if you believe that the existence of the state is good, then you should feel obligated to thank God in some way on Yom HaTzmut by saying Hallel, and especially for the miraculous fashion, turn the page, in which he, capital H, gave it to us. Yet we still need to discuss which particular methods would be halachically appropriate for expressing our gratitude. Rabbi Salvechik, I was told, was not in favor of saying Hallel on Yom HaTzmut, and we know that he was an incredible Zionist, religious Zionist. So just because you're a religious Zionist doesn't necessarily mean you're definitely saying halal, although most religious Zionists do. So there are basically three approaches that I want to run through with you. I want to start with the negative, and then next week we'll go to the positive. Okay?
Wait, can you just review again what's included in halal?
Halal has got a number of different psalms written by King David. And all those beautiful psalms that we sing. And it starts with a blessing and it ends with a blessing. It takes about 10 minutes to say. And it's only said on the festivals. Pesach, Sukkot, and Shavuot. It's a very important...
Sholosh
Regulin, very good. The three festivals. Also Rosh Chodesh, good. Also Rosh Chodesh. And there's a half Hallel and a full Hallel. We said a full Hallel the first days of Passover, but a half Hallel the second... Unless it means two of the psalms are omitted for a half hallel. Mm-hmm. There's all these details about it, but it's just a very important prayer. Mm-hmm. The reason why it becomes such an important part of our discussion about Israel is because it's kind of like the gauge of what you think about Israel. Because if you look at Israel as just another political entity, you may not say hallel. But if you look at it as like something messianic, something spiritual, something religious, then you're going to say hallel, usually. Make sense? So let's take, there are three approaches, anti, neutral, and pro. You got it? Anti-Zionist, neutral Zionist, pro-Zionist. Again, I shouldn't just use the word Zionist, I should say religious Zionist. Because I'm not really talking about the political entity. What's the political, secular concept of Zionism? What is it?
That Jews are entitled to their own state.
Yeah, Jews should have their own sense of self-determination, their own state. It was advanced by the late and great Theodor Herzl, who was originally, I just talked about in the last class, was an assimilationist. He thought that the answer to the Jewish problem was to fit in and to just culturally assimilate. Anybody know? You can't say this because you were just in this class before. Anybody know the Dreyfus trial? Basically convinced him otherwise. He was a reporter for an Austrian paper stationed in Paris, in France. And he realized... anti-Semitism doesn't distinguish between religious, not religious. They come after everybody.
But do you think it's a fair, just thing you can just have a nation state for Jews, regardless of the religious?
100%. I would be in favor of Zionism for its own sake, meaning without any kind of religious proponent. I just happen to believe there is a religious proponent. And I'm not going to say halal if it's just a secular state. I'm not going to say halal for Herzl. You know, because it's not, Herzl didn't believe that it was some sort of expression of God's hand or anything. And Hallel is saying thank you to God. You understand? So so we have to get into the...
But how do they, because I'm just reading it says since God put the Jewish people in exile, we must wait.
Okay, so let's start. Let's start with the anti-Zionist position. Okay. The first approach is the anti-Zionist, which is most clearly articulated in the writings of the late Satmar Rav, Rav Yoel Moshe Teitelbaum. Anybody familiar with Satmar Chassidim? There are many Satmar Chassidim. You should just know, before we say something that's going to upset you about Satmar Chassidim, because this probably will, you should know they're beautiful, holy people. And if you go to any hospital, most hospitals in New York City, there's a little Bikur Cholim room where they, without any fanfare, without any PR, they supply all of the food for Jews and non-Jews alike for... the Bikur Cholim rooms, for they do a lot of beautiful things. They just have terrible, terrible PR because they don't care. They do it for the because they believe it's the right thing to do. And I've spent a decent time in Muncie and become friends with some Satmar Chassidim, and they're amazing. I vehemently disagree with their view on this, but I want it to be properly articulated. That's why I'm giving you this article. So Rav Yoel Teitelbaum was one of the great rabbinic thinkers in the Satmar Hasidic. By the way, anybody know why they're called Satmar? It's interesting.
Is that the town
they're from? Yeah, St. Mary. St. Mary is a place in Hungary where most Satmars... You should know that most Hasidic... Lubavitch was from Lubav. I'm just saying like most Hasidic sects are named after the towns they're from.
So the guys that
the... No, they're not Satmar.
No, but they're
just...
Neturei Karta.
Yeah. I don't know where that is, actually.
Neturei
Karta.
It's Aramaic.
It means the guardian of the wall.
Yeah. By the way, I just want to tell you, I don't consider Neturei Karta a legit Hasidic group. First of all, a lot of them are just really off. I go to these rallies. I sometimes walk by and I talk to them. I look at them. I'm like, there's a lot of off people there, just in general. And they've done some really awful things. And I don't...
can you be more specific? What awful things?
They met with Ahmadinejad when he was in power, as he was threatening the Jewish state. Yeah. They tried to tell people that, you know, we agree with you that Israel shouldn't exist. And, you know, Satmar would never do that. Satmar vehemently opposes Zionism, but they would never do anything, God forbid, to place a fellow Jew in peril. They're beautiful people who have a very extreme view on Zionism, which I disagree with, but they're good Jews otherwise. The Satmar, the Neturei Karta, you know, you ever read the placards they hold up, the things they say?
Yeah. What is their purpose?
Nothing. They're just, it's a mess. And it's a tiny group. I don't think it's a very, it's not a serious, I haven't heard any great Torah scholars come out. The old Teitelbaum was like a serious Torah scholar. Like,
they're doing enough damage.
Yeah, they do some damage. They do. Just grab me that water, if you don't mind. I'm just so thirsty. Thank you. Huh?
No,
is it? Can you just grab me? Do you mind? Thank you.
Is that for a different...
If it's not...
You want Simeon or not?
Just unused.
Tom, thank you.
The CEO should be able to get a bottle of water.
Okay, let's wait till he leaves. Let's talk about Tom. By the way, did he? I'm sure.
Does Tom?
All right. So the first approach, he said the following. His name is Rav Yoel Moshe Teitelbaum. He's not alive anymore. Thank you. I appreciate it. And simply put, this opinion holds. Thank you. This opinion holds that since God put the Jewish people in exile, we have to wait until he redeems us. Why? How did we get out of Israel? We never talk about this.
Got forced out.
Why did we get kicked out? What do we believe spiritually the reason was? We say it in our prayers on Shabbat.
Hatred of each other.
Division.
Right. There were divisions. There were this. But we brought it on ourselves. We say it in our prayers. Because of our sins, galino me'artzeinu, we were exiled from our lands. We believe it was a godly thing. Even though the Romans did it in the second temple destruction, the Babylonians did it the first. But it started because we rebelled against God. So when your parents put you in a timeout, you don't just walk over to your parents after like 10 minutes of the timeout and say, I feel rehabilitated. I think I'm ready to come out. What do your parents say to you? Get back in the corner. Whatever the punishment was, get back up to your room, close the door. So that's kind of their view. God puts you in a big timeout, like a 2,000-year timeout for whatever it is that we did that brought. I don't want to get into that. That's for Tisha B'Av. We'll get to that over the summer, right? And we have to therefore wait for the parent to take us out of the timeout. Although it's permissible, according to the Satmar Rav, for individual Jews to live in Israel, and it may even be a mitzvah to do that, it's prohibited to organize mass immigration, as was done by the Zionist movement, and certainly prohibited to organize a Jewish government and an army to control the country. Since God put us in exile and has not yet miraculously redeemed us from exile, taking matters into our own hands by creating our own state is an evil act. Nothing less than a rebellion against God. And for that reason, the followers of the Satmar Rav hold that it's forbidden to cooperate with the government or participate in any of its activities. They neither pay taxes nor accept government benefits and do not vote in elections. It's important to note that the non-religious nature of the modern Israeli government is not significant. According to the Satmar Rav, even if every member of Knesset and every citizen of Israel were strictly observant, and if all the activities of the state were in strict conformity to halacha, the entire enterprise would remain severely forbidden and indeed evil. That's their view. Now, what would your response be when they say that unless God took us out and it was clear that it was from God, it was miraculous, what would your response be?
How do we not know?
What
do
you mean?
Wait.
Keep going. It's a miracle that we're back there.
What do you mean? What's it going to look like when God gives it to us? Good. The world, I don't understand.
No, but
how do we know, like, good, when redemption is coming? Like, how do we know when, right, the start of the redemption is? So yeah, how do we not know that this is the start of the ultimate,
good,
redemption?
Good. It's a very important thing. I when I was a kid, I used to, I don't know if I told you this, I used to daven really hard for the Mashiach to come. Did I ever tell you this?
No.
Now, specifically the night before math tests.
The stickers on the
lights. And checkups at the doctor. Because I hated checkups at the doctor. I still do. And I hated math. So I figured if the Mashiach came tonight, I wouldn't have to. So why is that? Like, well, I'm sharing this because I don't know what your concept of Mashiach is, whether you believe in it, you don't believe in it, but I was raised to believe in this thing called the Mashiach. So I just figured everything's going to be like this, and then bam, the Mashiach's going to come. No, it's a process. It's a process. In fact, there's a very beautiful midrash that one of the former chief rabbis of Israel, Avadya Yosef, former Sephardic chief rabbi of Israel, it's a midrash of two rabbis walking in the night. And they were up all night studying. And then they see the first light upon the horizon. You know, before the sun rises. In Hebrew, we call that Alot HaShachar, the beginnings of the morning. It's a beautiful time to be up. It's like you don't see the ball of the sun yet, but you see kind of a little light coming up. So one rabbi says to the next, and then afterwards, what do you see? Then you see a little glimmer of the ball. Wow. You know? How does the sun rise every morning? It's gradual. You don't go from pitch black to like the ball of the sun. We'd be blinded. It's gradual. And the rabbis say, Kach ki ge'ulatan, so is our redemption. It takes place in stages. So that would be the first reaction, which is, how do you know this is not God starting to take the Jewish people out of the time out? It's not like overnight, I'm going to be sitting pretty in the King David Hotel, and I was here, and like, it's a process. And by the way, I have to tell you, I felt it in the hotel, because like, I grew up going to these hotels for Pesach, like as a kid. There's so much more overlap between Israel and America today than there was 30 years ago. It's crazy how many people are flying back and forth all the time. Air travel, but it's also, the world is smaller. The whole world is smaller. We're 6,000 miles away and people are back and forth all the time.
So yeah. Do the Sephardic Jews think we're in like triple exile now based off of one, what's happening in Israel, and two, there's more division than even before October 7th?
Yeah.
How do you like quantify
that? I mean, they think what the Zionists did was sinful. To organize mass aliyah and to encourage people to go and to create a government. It's one thing to go and live there because there's a mitzvah to live in Israel. You know.
What's the response to October 7th? And what?
What do they think?
Is that like punishment?
I don't know. They never said that. They're sensitive people, and they know that even if they don't send their kids to the army, and I'll tell you, I went. When Jill and I went to visit Kfar Aza, I saw a number of Hasidic Rebbes coming to visit Kfar Aza, and they were hugging soldiers who were not wearing kippot, and they were giving blessings to soldiers. They've been sending Hasidim all over, to the north, to the south. There's a lot of achdus and love. They have their hashkafa, but they're still fellow Jews that are fighting. So they daven for their protection. They just don't daven for the government. See, our davening on Shabbos at MGE, we put in a special for the IDF, for the government, for the ministers, the Knesset. They don't do any of that. But they daven for fellow Jews. I got very upset once. I went to a dinner and it was a little more of a Haredi thing. I got involved in this organization and I wanted to get up and I said, you know, there was a terrorist attack and somebody should get up and say some Tehillim. And they didn't want to do it and I said, I won't say anything about the government. There were fellow Jews killed. Forget it. Pull the politics out of this thing. It's just, and they eventually, you know, understood that. And the world, the Jewish world, has come together pretty beautifully right now, irrespective of this.
Yeah. So we all believe Tisha B'Av, right? We're all on the same ground.
Yeah.
The division essentially caused the walls to be breached, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, fine. If we can all, Satmar can agree with us on that, then how do they justify being so up in arms, like in Yerushalayim when I was there, there was a massive protest. They shut down all transportation in the streets about not going into the military.
Yeah, I know.
Doesn't that create more division? Like, how
does it? It does. It's just that for them, I'm not defending it. The only reason I won't go crazy against it is because I don't have kids in the army and I'm not in Israel. So it's easy for me sitting pretty here in New York to say to everybody to go to the army. I'm not in the army. My kids are not in the army. But I can't imagine how difficult this is on an Israeli mother or father to have to see their kids go into Gaza. I went to visit my niece in Florida on one of the days of Chol HaMoed, and two of her brother-in-laws are in Gaza. I asked the dad, who's got two boys, I said, how are you? He's like, it's just like every time the phone rings, it's like, you know? And so I can't even imagine the pain and how difficult this is for like an Israeli parent to see their kids go into the army. And then someone else isn't because of the religious point of view. And that creates terrible, terrible tension in Israel. There's no question. Yeah, I would, if I was taken seriously in that community, I would tell them not to have rallies and to try to discuss this reasonably in quiet, you know, behind closed doors, because it's insensitive to all of the Jewish mothers and fathers that have to watch their kids go into the army. You know, and they're proud, by the way. Everybody's proud to, you know, it's like a rite of entry in Israel. It's such a major part of society, the army. But there is a lot of achdus right now. There is a lot of love and unity, and a lot of these Jews are getting along nicely otherwise. I'm vehemently opposed to, you know, sitting in yeshiva as opposed to going to the army. I think it's wrong. I also don't think it's the Torah perspective. If you study Tanakh, our greatest rabbis and heroes were warriors. It's not like a Jewish thing to just sit and learn. It's also a Jewish thing to defend yourself. King David was a great warrior. I don't have a great answer. I think you bring up an excellent point. It's very, very sensitive. Let's just read on a little more. The primary source for the Satmar Rav's position is the Gemara in Masechet Ketubot, last paragraph. The Gemara there tells us that at the time of the destruction of the temple, there were three oaths administered. Two of them were taken by the Jewish people and one by the non-Jewish nations. This is famous from the Talmud. The Jews were made to swear that they would not rise up in mass and return to the land of Israel. And they also swore that they would not rebel against the non-Jewish nations who enslaved them. And the non-Jews were made to swear, turn the page, that they would not enslave the Jews too harshly. The Satmar Rav claimed that by organizing mass immigration to Israel, declaring a sovereign government, and especially establishing an army, capturing the land by force, we have violated the first of two of these oaths. Now, my response to that is, number one, there are a lot of easy responses. They broke their end of the deal, which was they were not supposed to oppress us too harshly. I don't think anybody could look at Jewish history and go, oh, yeah, they didn't oppress us too harshly. Which period of history should we point to? You know, the Spanish Inquisition? Should it be the Christian Crusades? Should it be like the Khmelnytsky pogroms? We have one thing after the next. There's no deal anymore, as far as I'm concerned, between the Jews and like, you don't oppress us, and we won't, you know, create this entity in Israel. The other thing that I would say in response is that they say you're therefore not allowed to capture the land by force. Did Israel capture the land by force? Israel did not. Now you'll say, what do you mean? Israel's fighting wars all the time. But we did not take the land by force. That's important for the world to remember. People believe, and now I'll get into politics, that Israel was born in sin. The Arabs called Nakba, which is our day of right? We the nations of the world came together in this, what has become a terribly corrupt body of countries right now, but at that point it wasn't so bad. And they voted in favor of partitioning this land, of giving a part to the Jews and a part to the Arabs. We did not take it by force. We defended it by force. But that's not what those oaths are. So as far as I'm concerned, we are not violating any oaths that are mentioned in the Talmud, by rising up and you know, having sovereignty in the land of Israel. Now, there are a number of responses that could be brought to answer this challenge. He brings them up. Also, you know, and look at paragraph 3. Additionally, some have argued that our actions that led to the established state were not in violation. We swore that we would not rebel, that we would accept the authority of our masters, the non-Jews, but we never rebelled. The Balfour Declaration and the UN vote of November 29th, 1947 gave us permission to be there. And look at the last paragraph. Even if you don't accept either of these above points, you could still argue that we have been released from our commitment under the oaths by virtue of the fact that the non-Jews violated their oath. Now, what I'm sharing here is really, I want to say minority, but it's not really held so strongly by so many what we call Haredim. A Haredi Jew is like, I don't even know how to, what's a Haredi? Haredi Jew are not just Hasidim. They're also ultra-Orthodox Jews that, let's say, but most of them are not anti-Zionists. They're, we're going to get into the second category now. It's getting late. There, it's called the non-Zionists. Let's turn the page. Turn the page to page 4 on the bottom. Look at where it says B. However, as we have stated, the great majority of the Torah world and Torah scholars do not accept the Satmar Rav's position. Right? And he goes through why. We don't have to go through that. Oh, I'm sorry. Go to page five. Let's go to C. C is the non-Zionist approach. I'm sorry. However, many in the Orthodox world do not accept this approach either. Not only are they unwilling to ascribe messianic significance to the state of Israel, but they don't even view it as an entirely positive thing. Although they will certainly acknowledge with gratitude the many wonderful things that the state has done for individual Jews and for the observance of Torah u'mitzvot, they also note that the state and the government are not religious. That's probably the issue that the majority of Haredim have with the government and the state of Israel. First of all, the founders of Zionism, many of whom, and this is true, were heavily socialist / communist anti-religionists, Theodor Herzl included. Ben Gurion was an interesting personality because he quoted from Tanakh. He was very positive about the prophets. He's kind of anti-rabbinic a little, but he was the one that brokered the deal with a big rabbi at the time to have some people not fight in the army. But the deal was with a very small group. It's you know, ballooned into like 60,000 people now. But if you studied and read about what the early Zionists, and they were great heroes and leaders of the Jewish people, but they were very much anti. And this goes back in Europe. Most rabbis in Europe, most Orthodox rabbis in Europe were anti-Zionist because it was a movement that wasn't simply trying to bring Jews back to Israel. It was also trying to supplant Judaism with Zionism. It was trying to remove, now I'm not saying everybody, but there were a lot of like, you know, more secularists that were trying to kind of replace Torah with Zionism. This is going to be our new ism. And a lot of Jews actually left Yiddishkeit. They left what we call in Yiddish frumkeit. They left Torah observance, they left Shabbos, they left keeping kosher, and they joined these socialist / Zionist groups. I'm talking about from the early to mid-1900s. I used to talk to my Zaidi, you know, who was from Bialystok, Poland. They had these groups in Bialystok. They had them all over, and there were a lot of Jews that were leaving the fold. We have this vision, you know, that before the war, everybody was religious. You know, and then the Holocaust happened. That's not true. There were a lot of Jews that were leaving Torah observance. Not all of them were leaving, you know, in favor of... Now, that's why religious Zionism is so important, because what religious Zionism attempts to do, and that's what we believe in here, is really to fuse the two, is that the fuel for your Zionism is the Torah. And then the fact that so many of the early Zionist leaders were anti-Torah, okay, that was their view. Vehemently disagree with it, just like I do the Satmar Rav's view. But their problem is not because we were put in a timeout and we pulled ourselves out. It's that the people that are proposing Zionism are not Torah personalities. So how could you follow these people who are not teaching Torah, and they're not trying to bring Jews back to Israel to get closer to God. They're just using it as a safe haven. And they're setting up a Western democracy like any other Western democracy. They're following British common law. They're letting the buses run on Shabbos, and the cinemas open on Friday nights. They're not, and there's no kosher food. There was no kosher food in the Israeli army, by the way, before a certain time. It was easier to be a religious Jew in the American army at some point than it was in the Israeli army, because there were a lot of very anti-religious Jews in the government. It's true. I'll tell you a quick story of Shlomo Gorin, who was the chief rabbi of the Israeli army during the Six-Day War. He was a tough son of a gun, and he was an ardent religious Zionist. He came in the early 1900s with his family from Poland, part of a Hasidic family, but they were different. They were very into settling the land and working with the secular Zionists. And there was no kosher food in the army. And he was already friends with a higher upper echelon in the army. And he went to the chief of staff and he said, "This is ridiculous. We are a Jewish army and we're feeding our soldiers treif, non-kosher food." He says, "Shlomo, when you start jumping out of planes, we'll have kosher food." So he signed up for the Tzanchanim, for the paratroopers course. He jumped out of planes. He became like a soldier. He broke his leg jumping out of a plane. This is true. You can read his autobiography. And he came to the chief of staff. He says, "I jumped out of planes. Where's my kosher food?" And they started putting kosher food. Now, every single army base is kosher. There's no such thing. You're not allowed to bring non-kosher food into an army base. Okay, I'm not saying everybody's keeping kosher in general, but it's different today. But it wasn't always like that. So to keep following with me here. So although it's the non-religious and sometimes anti-religious, they point out that there's much state-sponsored chilul Shabbat, violations of Shabbos, as well as, one Rebbe of mine used to constantly talk about the tens of thousands of abortions that have been paid for by the Israeli Ministry of Health. In addition, the Israeli secular educational system has educated an entire generation of Jewish children to be largely ignorant, and in some cases hostile towards their Torah heritage. Yeah. So this was the main problem. It wasn't like the exile. It wasn't that philosophical. It's like, there's no Yiddishkeit in this thing. How could we get involved in a movement that has no Yiddishkeit to it?
He's the religious Zionist.
Yeah. Now, by the way, I'll take your question in a minute. Who was the one rabbinic figure that changed this point of view to some degree? Well, I'll come back to it after. Tom, you ask your question first.
Yeah, a while back when we talked about abortions, we were talking about the Jewish attitude toward abortion. Mm-hmm. Isn't it not entirely against
Correct.
It?
Correct. Correct. But it is. There are exceptions, unlike the Catholic Church. A woman's life is in danger, or if even, according to some opinions, a woman couldn't handle having the child, but economic reasons is not enough. We've talked about this. But those exceptions prove the general rule. The general rule is that abortion is forbidden. There are some exceptions, though. But he's saying here is that abortions are regularly happen in Israel, even though it doesn't fall under one of the exceptions. Because it's not following the halachic government entity. It's just following regular law. So that's, I think, a big issue. What would your response to that be? How could you therefore be a religious Zionist if the people promoting Zionism were anti-religious? Because who were two big rabbis that were very pro-Zionist, and they were very Orthodox rabbis, and they were the biggest rabbinic giants of their respective communities?
Rav Kook,
the first chief rabbi of Israel, who used to go to these secular kibbutzes and hug the chalutzim. They thought he was crazy. He'd show up with his long black coat and his long white flowing beard. He felt that what? He didn't care. Now, of course he cared if a Jew wasn't following halacha. But the fact that a Jew was not keeping, observance, Torah observance, to him didn't take away from what religious Zionism is about, which is what? For Rav Kook. We're going to talk more about it next week. The Mashiach. God works through interesting personalities. And Rav Kook believed that the Zionists were bringing the Mashiach. He didn't believe Ben-Gurion was the Mashiach, but he believed that that creating a political entity called a state in the land of our forefathers and getting Jews to come back to Israel was step one in the Messianic redemption. The fact that the people doing it were not into the Mashiach, maybe didn't even believe in the Mashiach or even God, was irrelevant for him, because God works in mysterious ways. And he just felt that they were doing God's work, and therefore he supported what was called in Hebrew the Yeshuv, which is the settlement of Jews back in Israel. Rav Soloveitchik had a different view. He also was extraordinarily positive about Zionism, and also was not put off by the fact that the leaders were not themselves observant, because he felt that what happened in 48 and later in 67 was a clear expression of God's hand in history. And if God is knocking at your door, then you don't get involved in little details of who's the leader and whether they believe in this, they don't believe in that. God is helping the Jewish people come back to Israel. The Rav, Rav Soloveitchik, did not speak in messianic terms like Rav Kook did. You guys know his name is Rabbi Abraham Isaac Kook. He was a genius of a Talmudist. He was also a great mystic. He was a big Kabbalist. He studied in Europe and he came to Israel and he became the first chief rabbi of Israel. He was a very, very loving Jew. And a lot of the religious Zionists in Israel today follow Rav Kook's ideology. Most of the religious Zionists coming out of the United States follow Rav Soloveitchik's ideology. We'll study a little more about them next week. But each of them essentially, I wouldn't say they ignored the fact that the promoters of Zionism were not observant religious Jews, but they could still embrace Zionism anyway, because it was accomplishing amazing things, and it was still some expression of either the Messianic redemption in Rav Kook's view, or an expression of God's hand in Rav Soloveitchik's view. And each of them got themselves into a lot of trouble in the Orthodox world because of this. Rav Soloveitchik was persona non grata in the Orthodox world after he left the Aguda, which was the most prominent rabbinic association that his father and his grandfather were the heads of. And he basically pulled out of the Aguda after the state was created, and he joined what was called the Mizrahi, which is basically like the modern Orthodox kind of group. And Rav Kook did the same thing, and they held fast in their views, and they basically created a whole generation of hundreds and hundreds of thousands of young Jewish people who believe both in Torah and in the state of Israel. I'm not talking about the land. Remember, the land is not controversial. Everybody believes the land is holy. I'm talking about the government of the state of Israel.
The controlling bodies.
What's that? Yeah, the secular entity, the political body, the government, the army, that whole thing. Any questions, comments?
Isn't there also kind of like a lot of the views about Judaism are that, like, the reason, like, it's a mitzvah to help other Jews fulfill mitzvahs.
Yeah.
And so looking at settling the land of Israel as being this, like, oh, you know, it's a good thing for an individual to go there, but, like, we can't all go there. It's kind of interesting to me that they wouldn't see that as a benefit to, if we encourage other Jews to move here,
right,
even before, maybe even if we're not all religious or whatever, like, that's still helping them do a mitzvah. And, like, that's
it is. What mitzvahs are you facilitating by building up the land of Israel or the state or the government? What mitzvahs? Throw them out. It's true.
You're supposed to settle the land.
First of all, the mitzvah to settle the land. Good. What else?
Planting.
What's that?
Trees.
Yeah, there's a lot of mitzvahs that have to do with the trees and the agriculture. That's true. What else? What about just Torah? Creating an environment where more and more Jews study and learn and grow. Do you know, does anybody know who the biggest funder of Torah institutions in the world is? The government of the state of Israel. And I always say this when people say the people who created the state were anti-religious, but bottom line, more money has been pumped into yeshivas in Israel by the government of Israel than any group of individuals in the history of the Jewish people. And it's just now that could have been because of politics and, you know, yeah, that's placating this and and that's why I never understood this. Why would you find a guy with a yarmulke and a beard in the Knesset if they're so anti, if the Haredim are like parva about Israel? So they're not anti like the Satmar. right? But they're non-Zionists because it's promoted by people that are not observant, and it's promoting non-observance. So why are there so many religious Jews in the Knesset?
Benefits.
Yeah, I was thinking about that.
Because if you wanted to get your society to be more religious, to be more connected, welcome, Rabbi Pinney, what are you going to do? You got to get into the Knesset so you can start wheeling and dealing like everybody else. Now, it sounds corrupt, but it's not corrupt. That's called a democracy. It's a parliamentary democracy. That's the way the prime ministers stay in power. I think it needs to be revised. I think it's awful. I think it's a mess of a system. But no democratic system is perfect. And by the way, that's what was going on before October 7. That's why, you know, I personally believe that the Supreme Court had way too much power. I don't think they did it in the right way, but they don't have a constitution. Israel really needs a constitution. But that's a whole separate thing, yeah.
But the Torah and Judaism is actually still really ingrained. For example, and the idea, right now you have rabbis declaring hostages dead, one, based off of what we believe is the right thing to do in the Torah, and also evidence that they're able to get. I think it's interesting that they have that, and I don't know how much they're involved when it comes to missions and operations and things that they are currently doing inside of Gaza, but I always found it fascinating that rabbis are part of the IDF. And
oh, huge.
They're not, right?
No, they're a huge part of the IDF.
So right now they're making decisions.
They're not making the decisions. The IDF is a military infrastructure. It makes decisions based on strategy and what the prime minister, the chief, you know, just like this, the United States, it's the president is the commander-in-chief. He makes the decision and the army carries it out. That's the way Israel works. But because the army is so, and by the way, it's changed in the last 25, 30 years. The percent, you know, the 25% of all officers in the Israeli army are religious. Officers. You know, that's huge. So, you know, to say that, you know, religious Jews don't serve in the army, it's a segment of the Orthodox world that does not serve in the army. So therefore, you're going to have a lot of great religious figures in the army. You're going to have great rabbis. But the rabbis are not making policy. They're helping. They're helping like everybody's trying to help Israel now in the IDF. Is anybody here of what's called a Hezder unit?
It's like the settlers.
No.
Oh. I thought it was like the...
It's a part of the government. It's part of the army. So another reason why a lot of religious Jews, let's say more Haredi world, don't want to enter the army is because, and this is a reality, I don't disagree with him on this point.
You have to fight on Shabbat?
No, it's a mitzvah to defend yourself. It's okay to fight on Shabbat, just like it's mitzvah to save a life if you have to.
You can't study Torah.
Oh, you study and learn it.
Okay, you won't be able to learn as much.
And
but
like,
what else?
Observance can be.
It's very hard to stay religious in the army.
Yeah.
It is. So years ago, and I studied in one of these yeshivas, there's probably about 15 of them in Israel, maybe 20. They're called Hezder units, where the army is 3 years in Israel, but what you do is sign up for a five-year program, of which you spend 18 months in the army, three six-month stints in the army, and then the rest of the time studying in yeshiva. Some of the best fighters in Israel are Hezder students, but they're not serving 3 years in the army, they're only serving 18 months. But they're committing to a five-year program. Now, why are they some of the best soldiers, even though they're putting in less time in the army? What do you guys think? What's that? They're very idealistic because they're studying Torah. Those are the guys. I met so many of these guys. I spent years in yeshiva with some of these guys. To me, they're like, those are the ultimate Jews to me. Because they're so pumped about their Torah and their Judaism and about defending the Jewish people, they know exactly what they're fighting for. There's a big malaise in the army where if you don't have a particular ideology and you don't really know what you're fighting for, then it's not great for morale. All right, we're going to finish up here. I'm going to pick up on this next week.
And to ask you, Rabbi Pinney, this question.
Sure, Rabbi Pinney loves being attacked the second he walks in. Wait, before you ask the question, I want to make one or two quick announcements, Yoel. Is that okay? First of all, I want to thank Yoel Sadian for helping us out these last Pesach. Those of you here, I'm sure he was amazing. Coming in. He flew in on his private jet from L.A. He doesn't always do that. The gas is very expensive. And number two, so Monday night, I mentioned, is Yom HaShoah, and the following Monday night is Yom HaTzmaut. So we're having events here. We're going to continue with our discussion of religious Zionism next week, please God. And Friday Night Lights has been moved to 7. It's no longer at 6:30 or 6:45. It's 7 o'clock. We've got some great musicians coming and a barbecue, which is really fun. What we didn't get to talk about, and then Shabbos morning, we have a guest speaker that I spoke to before, so please join us. I did not get to talk to you about the Omer, which is the counting that we do every day. Mm-hmm. But with your permission, I'd like to, even though we didn't get to talk about what it is, I'll discuss it next week. I don't want to take time away from Rabbi Pinney. But is it okay if we count the Omer together?
Go for it.
Can we do that?
Yeah.
All right, because I didn't count it yet.
Yesterday was 8.
Okay.
It's 9.
Oh, don't say it yet. Come, have it. Please, stand up. We'll make the if you haven't been saying it every night, you can just answer amen to my blessing, and then we'll say it together. Yesterday was 8. Yesterday. See if you can figure out what tonight is. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam, asher kedushanu b'mitzvotav v'tzivanu al sfirat Ha Omer. Okay, let's do it together. Hayom. Tesha Yamim. Shehem. Shavua Echad. Shtei Yamim Ba Omer. Which means today is 9 days, which is 1 week and 2 days of the Omer. We have a little more time, maybe on Shabbat we'll talk about it a little more, what the Omer is. I'm sorry, we're just doing it without even discussing what it's about. We should have done it before Passover. All right, guys, take a 2-minute break. Come back with Rabbi Pinney. We want to try to get you out at a normal hour. And welcome back, everyone.
Yeah. 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 Yeah